Hey, Cindy.
Yes.
I was just starting on some planning for the House of Frankenstein this year, and did you know the last episode of this season will be episode 100 of Supermates?
Nuh-uh, really?
Yep, of course, if we'd stayed bi-weekly, we'd probably be closer to 200, but.
So, do you think we should do something special for it, like throw a party or something?
Well, we could. A party? Oh, splendid! I do enjoy a good soiree. We can really spruce up the old house out back and throw the gala of the year.
Oh, jeez. I'm sorry I opened my big...
Solomon Grundy like parties, too. Grundy can bring tin bean dip. Like all hulkish man-brutes, Grundy like him some beans. Now, hold on, guys. No one said for sure we were going to throw a party.
Why am I even answering this?
Good evening, Miss Arcade.
Cain and Abel, party planners. Really? Seriously? What don't you two do?
Not much. We plan wonderful parties, especially funerals. Of course, I need the casket back. Oh, yes. Quiet! I told you to let me do the talking. I can wear my hat and tails. Oh, wait. I wear that for all eternity. Simon Grundy also makes a mean punch. Pick swamp water, a flattened toad, Spanish moss. Well, looks like we're having a party.
I think I liked it better when we were trying to blow this place up.
There's a creepy old house out in the hills. A domicile of weirdness, horror, and thrills. Where of Frankenstein, a strange couple there. Who are your hosts? They talk of comics and movies with monsters and ghosts. A peculiar place where the sun doesn't shine. It's the house of Frankenstein.
Hello and welcome to episode 97 of Supermates, the husband and wife geekcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Cindy.
And welcome to our first episode of the House of Frankenstein for 2021. Here to provide you a spooky respite from the real horrors of the world for four episodes leading up to Halloween.
Yeah, for real.
We all thought we'd just be wearing Halloween masks again. We were, and now we're back, but here we go. Anyway. Last year, we covered the classic Universal horror film Son of Frankenstein, so this year, we thought we'd kick things off by covering its direct sequel, so let's just get rolling. The Ghost of Frankenstein was released April 3rd, 1942.
April!
Just in time for Easter.
Yeah, you know.
The story was by Eric Taylor, screenplay.
Well, Resurrection.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. Screenplay, that's offensive to some people.
No, it's like a lot offensive, but I'm just, you know.
Yeah, screenplay, story by Eric Taylor, screenplay by Scott Darling, music by Hans J. Salter, and directed by Earl C. Kenton. In the cast, we had Lon Chaney Jr. this time as the Frankenstein monster, Sir Cedric Hardwick as Ludwig Frankenstein, and the ghost of Henry Frankenstein, that's where that comes in. Ralph Bellamy played Eric Ernst, Lionel Atwell was Dr. Theodore Bomer, Bela Lugosi returns as Igor. Evelyn Ankers played Elsa Frankenstein. Janet Ann Gallo played Cloistine Hussman. Barton Yarbrough played Dr. Kettering. Doris Lloyd played Martha. Leyland Hodgson was Chief Constable. Olaf Heighton was Hussman. That's Cloistine's father. And Holmes Herbert played the magistrate.
There's a curse on our village. The curse of Frankenstein.
Mother was Frankenstein, that your mother was the lightning,
the most dreaded creation of man. the monster of Frankenstein stalks again. Here is a story completely new. Here is drama completely strange, full of weird suspense. With this great cast, Sir Cedric Hardwicke, Lionel Atwill, Ralph Bellamy, Bela Lugosi, Evelyn Ankers, Lon Chaney, in the gripping tale of a monster the tomb cannot engulf, chains cannot hold.
You're going to give him life?
Yes. Not for the purposes that you think, Igor. I'm giving him another brain.
Is that your shower, husband?
Yes, yes.
The villagers are getting out of hand, Doctor. If you expect the protection of my office, you'll have to be frank with me. I think the time's come for a showdown, Doctor.
People of the village of Frankenstein are upset and angry. They feel their town has been cursed by the family who founded it. The mayor decides to just let the angry mob have their way and destroy the remaining vestige of the Frankenstein family, their ancestral castle. When they arrive, they find the surprisingly not dead Igor, who tries to dissuade them by pushing large stones off the parapets. But the villagers persist and begin dynamiting the castle. The explosion's seismic results reach the sulfur pit below the old tower, where Frankenstein's monster has been trapped for some time. Freed from his prison, Igor takes his friend into the woods as the mob succeeds in destroying the castle, unaware they've unleashed their worst nightmare once again.
As Igor and the monster navigate the woods through a storm, the monster inexplicably reaches out to the heavens. He is struck by a bolt of lightning right in his neck electrode and stands stronger afterwards. Igor now knows his friend needs a recharge because his father was Frankenstein, but his mother was the lightning! And heads to the town of Assyria to find yet another son of Frankenstein, Ludwig. Dr. Ludwig Frankenstein is a noted psychologist running an asylum and specializing in experimental brain surgery to heal the mentally ill. He is aided by his former mentor, the obviously bitter Dr. Bomer, who was disgraced years ago by a medical mishap, and the young and optimistic Dr. Kettering.
When the ghastly duo arrives, the monster observes some boys picking on a young girl named Cloyston Hussman. The monster picks up the girl and heads to the rooftops to retrieve the ball the boys had kicked away from her. A crowd quickly assembles, and in a panic, two men approach the monster, attempting to save the girl from him. Instead, the monster murders each with one blow. The monster reluctantly hands Cloyston to her father and is apprehended by a throng of the local police. Local prosecutor Eric Ernst visits the home of his girlfriend Elsa, but this isn't a social call. He wants Elsa's father, Ludwig Frankenstein, to examine the murderous brute they have in custody. After Eric leaves, another guest reveals himself, Igor. The shifty shepherd reveals it is the monster created by Ludwig's father that the police have in custody. If Ludwig doesn't agree to help restore the monster, Igor will blow the whistle on the dirty family secret the respected doctor has kept hidden from the people of Viseria.
At the courthouse, the monster is questioned but cannot speak. Even young Cloyston, who approaches the chained brute, can only elicit a smile from his snarled mouth. The monster reacts differently when Dr. Frankenstein enters the room. When the creature seems to recognize him, Ludwig feigns ignorance, which enrages the beast. He breaks his chains as the courthouse clears out. Outside, Igor uses his horn to soothingly lure the monster to him, and the two escape in a horse-drawn wagon. Later, at the Frankenstein Sanitarium, Elsa looks over the notebooks her father has left on his desk. They once belonged to her grandfather and uncle and tell of the creation of the monster and his resurrection years later. Elsa looks out the window to see the faces of Igor and his companion as the lightning flashes outside. She runs to her father, who assures her that she was only imagining things, but Ludwig is wrong. And the monster crashes through the basement door of the sanitarium and murders Dr. Kettering. When Ludwig and Elsa respond, the monster grabs the girl, forcing Ludwig to lock himself into his lab and flood the hallway with gases used to subdue violent patients. Despite his struggles, the gas eventually leaves the monster unconscious.
Ludwig decides he must destroy the creature before he murders anyone else. He plans to dissect him bit by bit, but Dr. Bomer wants no part of what he considers murder. While contemplating his dilemma, Ludwig sees a vision of his late father. Henrik Frankenstein tells his son that the monster was only a failure due to him unwittingly placing a criminal brain in his skull. Ludwig then hits upon the idea of resurrecting the good Dr. Kittering in the body of the beast. Dr. Bomer is on board, but Igor is opposed, not wanting to lose his friend. He suggests that Ludwig take his brain and place it into the monster, freeing him of his broken and misshapen body. Ludwig flatly refuses, knowing that the cunning Igor would make for an even worse monster. Igor then convinces Dr. Bomer that if he were in the powerful monster's body, he could take over the country and appoint Bomer as the head medical regent.
At Ludwig's instruction, Igor tells the monster about the doctor wanting to give him a new brain. The preparations are interrupted by the arrival of Eric and the local police, still searching for the monster and aware of the disappearance of Dr. Kettering. Eric searches the premises against Ludwig's wishes and even finds the hidden dungeon cell where Igor and the monster were staying, but they are both gone. The monster has plans of his own and abducts young Chloe Stein from her home, inadvertently starting a fire as he leaves. He brings the girl back to the lab, and when Igor tries to interfere, he crushes his old friend behind a large wooden door. The monster enters the Frankenstein's living quarters and points to Chloe Stein's head and then his own. He wants to have her brain in his body. Elsa is eventually able to get the girl away from the monster, and Frankenstein convinces him to allow the operation to begin, the monster thinking he's going to get the brain he wants.
Ludwig begins the operation procedures while Bomer secretly meets with the mangled and dying Igor. Bomer brings in the brain, and they begin the experiment. 2 weeks later, and the monster still hasn't regained consciousness, but Ludwig is hopeful. The townspeople, however, are fed up. The monster is still on the loose, and Herr Husband believes his daughter was abducted, not killed in the fire that destroyed his home. They surmise the monster could only be hiding at the sanitarium and head off with torches and pitchforks. Of course they do. Eric stops them at the gates and convinces him to let him talk to Frankenstein before they begin their pillaging. Inside, Ludwig comes clean about the monster and the operation meant to save the life of Kettering. He takes Eric to meet the newly conscious monster, only to have the creature speak in familiar, raspy Hungarian tones. This is not Kettering, but Igor, who announces his plans to use the monster's immortal body and undying strength to rule the world.
As the villagers attack the sanitarium, Eric flees, leaving Ludwig to grapple with both the monster and Bomer. But Igor soon loses his sight and calls out to Bomer for help. A dying Ludwig informs them that they didn't account for the different blood types of Igor in the monster, and that the sensory nerves will no longer work. Enraged, Igor kills Bomer by throwing him into one of the electrical machines. Upstairs, Elsa hands Chloe Stein to her father as her and Eric run from the burning, crumbling mansion. Stumbling about, the monster knocks over a large cabinet full of chemicals and sets the lab on fire. While he burns, the ceiling caves in, crushing him beneath the debris. Eric and Elsa look back at the crumbling remains of her home, another victim of the curse of Frankenstein. Okay, so this movie is obviously a direct sequel to Son of Frankenstein, picking up with Igor and the monster where we left off with them, but it's also a production sequel to The Wolfman from the year before. Chaney, Lugosi, Anchors, and Bellamy all came over from that production, as did Wolfman director George Wagner, who is a producer here. The Wolfman actually wrapped on production on November 27th, 1941, and this film started production on December 15th of that year, ending on January the 15th, and then it was released on April the 3rd. They cranked these movies out back then.
I'm telling you, I mean, think about that. That's over the Christmas holidays, and I mean, just boom.
You know, they took some days off for Christmas.
Yeah.
And I mean, this was right when Pearl Harbor was happening. Mm-hmm. Actually, The Wolfman came out, I think, the week Pearl Harbor happened, so it literally... The Wolfman literally finished production like about a week before it was released.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the film was probably still warm. The director here is Earl C. Kenton, who had directed Lugosi before in the classic Island of Lost Souls from 1932, the first adaptation of the Island of Dr. Moreau, at least the first talking one. There may have been a silent one. That starred Charles Laughton. He would go on to contribute to the Universal Monster Cycle with both House of Frankenstein and House of Dracula, which we covered previously on House of Frankenstein. He began his career as an actor and was one of the original Keystone Cops.
Right.
I like the score by the always wonderful Hans J. Salter, who contributed to many of Universal's horror films. Of course, you hear some of the other Universal stock music from the previous horror efforts, especially The Wolfman, which was, of course, fresh. But this one has that oddly powerful, triumphant music in it, too. Mm-hmm. That dun-da-da-da-da. It reminds me a bit of the Fleischer Superman score from this time.
Yeah.
By Sammy Timberg. I don't really know why this has that triumphant. It's like when the monster gets re-energized, it does it, but it does it at other points too, and it's like, that's weird. They kind of carry over the monster's theme from Son of, but it's kind of weird. So last time, Wolf von Frankenstein deeded his lands and his castle to the townspeople and got the heck out of Dodge with his wife and his son. But that's not good enough for the villagers. They want to tear it down. You know, why not make a tourist attraction out of it? I mean, you know, see Castle Frankenstein, House of Horrors, you know, all this stuff. They could have made a mint out of that. You know, they're all like, oh, our crops are dying. You know, we have no bread for the children. It's like an amusement park. You know, so.
Well, you know.
I know. Who knows that we're in this undisclosed period.
Yes.
In this film. But, because, I mean, actually now, I mean, you could say this, the Wolfman clearly happened. There was a, you know, a car at the beginning of it. We don't see any cars in this movie. So we don't know what time period it is. We don't know how much time period there is between this movie and Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. Mm-hmm. But anyway. The villagers actually say the phrase, "The Curse of Frankenstein," which will, of course, be the title of Hammer's first Frankenstein film, which will kick off their incredibly successful horror cycle. So, mm-hmm. So that's another interesting thing. We don't see Inspector Krog, who was so prominent in the town of Frankenstein in the last film, of course, with the wooden arm and everything. And that's because Lionel Atwell has been recast as Dr. Bomer.
Oh, Anna.
We do see two familiar cast members from Son of that we shouldn't see, despite being murdered by the monster at Igor's bidding. In a major plot point in the film, actors Lionel Belmore and Michael Mark are back as members of the town council. Did you catch that?
I know. I was like, wait a minute. What? You know. Okie doke.
Now, they never say these are the same characters. Maybe they're their brothers and they replaced them on the council. But it's still, it's still weird. I mean, these movies, I mean, they have a very limited pool of contract players that they pull from for these films.
Well, it's kind
of
like Adam Sandler in all his films. He uses the same people just over and over again.
It's true. Steve Buscemi's this guy now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Belmore and Mark go all the way back to the original 1931 Frankenstein. Belmore playing the Burgermeister there. And, of course, Michael Mark was the father of poor little Maria.
Yeah.
Yeah. The mayor points out the monster is destroyed and Igor is dead, or he should be. They directly address that Wolf shot Igor at point-blank range multiple times. But yet some of the villagers claim to have seen him playing his horn trying to waken the monster. So my question to you, is Igor some kind of revenant? Is he undead? Is he like Rasputin, who they apparently tried to murder multiple times.
Yeah.
It just wouldn't die. I mean, is it the beard? I mean,
don't know.
I mean, this guy's like more undead than Lugosi's Dracula. I mean, he's harder to kill than Lugosi's Dracula. Lawrence Grant, who plays the mayor here, goes uncredited despite reprising his role from Son of, although there he was known as the Burgermaster. So they're just throwing the terminology around. We also see a very familiar face in the crowd, none other than Dwight Fry, famous for playing Renfield in Dracula, Fritz, the original assistant in the original Frankenstein, and Carl in Bride of Frankenstein. He shows up uncredited as the villager who demands the castle be destroyed. He's got a bad history with the Frankensteins. So
yeah,
maybe that's
didn't like him.
No. Yeah. What do you think about the mayor agreeing to let the villagers run amok just because they threatened to vote in a new mayor later?
Well, that's a politician for you.
Some things never change.
Change, right?
Yeah. The castle looks quite a bit different here, too. Apparently, Kenton wasn't into the avant-garde German expressionism and crooked angles style that Roland V. Lee was in Son of Frankenstein.
Right.
Remember the gate with the, you know, it looked like Tim Burton, you know, I mean, to our modern eyes, but it's the German expressionism, yeah. You pointed out when we were watching this how they quickly get tons of dynamite in this film.
How does that happen? They just had all the dynamite. They went straight from the meeting. Oh, okay, you pick up some of your from your house. You pick up from some of your house. I'm like, what do these people do?
There's a dynamite closeout store on the edge of town, I guess.
Okay,
I don't know.
Okay.
It's about to go bad, so they got good prices on it. When they see Igor on top of the castle, kicking parts off the parapets on him, they say, an even better reason to blow up the castle. But can you really blame him? I mean, you know,
they know he's a murderer. They've, you know, he's been sentenced to die. You know, I'm like,
I stole bodies. Yeah. They say, you know,
that's not.
And he murdered. He had the monster murder all the council people that had him hung.
Yeah.
So yeah, die already, you old coot. You know, basically. The explosions, I mean, they're really impressive in this film.
Yeah, they are.
I mean, the editing is really tight. It cuts away before you realize you're looking at miniatures.
Mm-hmm.
It's really super well done.
Yeah, it is really well done.
It's really well done. It's those old school practical effects that just look. This movie, the action stuff in this movie looks like a million bucks. It really does. It's been pointed out many times in the past, but it seems like Igor went to the orthodontist between films because his gnarly, crooked teeth are gone. You know, he had those awful teeth. He looks far more benign without them, but, you know, looks can be deceiving, of course.
Exactly.
So, here we meet the monster, and for the first time, he's not played by Boris Karloff. Instead, Universal's biggest horror star at the time, Lon Chaney Jr., steps into the platform boots and headpiece. And actually, that, you know, Karloff was, I think, only about 5'11", and Chaney was 6'3".
Dang.
So he makes for a much bigger,
more imposing,
burlier monster. Yeah, he's not cadaverous by any means, but he's definitely.
And why did Karloff step away?
Karloff felt, after Son of One, he felt he was getting too old for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because Karloff was, you know, in his 40s when he was discovered, you know, as the monster. So he was in his 50s, but he celebrated his 50th birthday on the set of Son of, I believe, or 51st or something like that. And he felt like he was getting too old. He also felt like, correctly, the monster was becoming more of a prop than a character.
Gotcha.
And we get a little more character in this one, a little more screen time from Chaney in this one. But by the time Glenn Strange is playing the monster, he is a prop. I mean, I like Glenn Strange as a monster, but he's set dressing almost, especially in the House of movies.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll get into how much Chaney suffered for his part in a bit. But just look at this scene where Igor frees him. He's actually covered in all that fake sulfur. And apparently that was like cement that they covered him in.
Dang.
And he had like straws to breathe through to, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you know, apparently it's made out of cement. I mean, Lugosi actually had to dig him out. And apparently they left him on the set, you know, in that while they went to lunch or something like that.
Nice. Just,
yeah. This is your star. I can't imagine the monster smells great on a good day, but to be encased in sulfur for at least a few years, I mean, he must reek.
I know, and I'm allergic to sulfur, so, you know, I'd be like...
Yeah, I mean, anytime we drive by anything with a sulfur leak or anything like that, you're just like, ugh, you get sick.
I get nauseous and get a headache, and, you know...
Yeah. It looks like the monster has on that weird fur vest Karloff hated in the last film, although it doesn't seem very furry here. But he's got like one big solid piece at first. Makeup master and Universal monster creator Jack P. Pierce covered Chaney in actual mud to simulate the sulfur covering on him. When he pulled him out, he still was all covered in sulfur.
Stuff,
So I bet Chaney's skin was actually really soft.
He had a mud bath.
Yeah.
There you go.
Put little cucumbers on his you know, big old eyelids that they put on. His skin actually had a bad reaction to the rubber headpiece that Pierce used. It left horrible rashes on his skin. And one day Chaney became so uncomfortable sweating under the rubber with all the rash and, you know, the irritation that he had. He ripped the forehead piece off and he cut a huge gash in his already raw forehead.
Oh.
So the production had to take a break for a few days for it to heal. So, yeah. It almost seems like there's a cut scene when we find the monster running away from Igor to find the lightning, but then films were cut abruptly back then.
Exactly.
So, I don't know. When Chaney is walking with his arm stretched out to find the lightning, I wonder if that's partially, at least, where the famous Frankenstein walk comes from, you know, with your arms out.
Yeah.
Because I know scholars always point to Lugosi groping about in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman because he's supposed to be blind.
Mm-hmm.
See the end of this movie, and we'll talk about that, of course. But Chaney does do it several times here in this movie. And Lugosi was exposed to Chaney's take on the character here, so maybe that was a bit of an influence.
I don't know.
I just noticed that this time that he does not do it all the time. I mean, and Karloff never did it. He stalked about, you know, with his, he moved his hands around at his side, and and always acted like he was kind of skulking around as the monster, you know. Of course, like I said, Igor gets one of his most famous lines about, you know, your father was Frankenstein, but your mother was the lightning. So I had to point that out again. That's great. It's in the trailer. It's great. Then we head off to visit the heretofore unknown second son of Frankenstein. So do you think he's Wolf's younger brother?
I don't know. I'm very confused about the dynamics there.
Yeah, they say second, and Hardwick, I looked it up, even though he looks older, he's a year younger than Basil Rathbone. So you think because he was the second son, he got screwed out of the estate, much like Larry was, Talbot was going to get screwed out of the estate by his brother?
Right.
And or do you think he just didn't want any part of it, and that's why, you know, because obviously has tried to...
But he kept his name.
Yeah, that's another point we'll get to. He kept his name. So, what do you think?
I don't know, and especially where they're able to travel there, and it seems like relatively quickly... Why didn't those townspeople know about Frankenstein and he'd been there for a while and built a life there? And I'm confused.
Yeah, he'd been there long enough to have a daughter, apparently, and she's like in her 20s somewhere.
Yeah.
And now for the first time, we visit the peaceful village of Visaria, and which is the setting of just about every other Universal Monster film following this, except for the Mummy one. So.
Right.
Is it kind of dickish for Frankenstein to bring up Bulmer's mistake right after their surgery is finished? I mean, way to be Captain Bringdown, you know, and say, I did it right and you did it wrong. I mean, am I wrong that's like rubbing salt in the wound.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. He's got such a haughty nature that I don't think he like intentionally did it, but it's like, dude, be a little sensitive about the guy. You know, he was your mentor. So I don't know. Ludwig Frankenstein is played by Sir Cedric Hardwick, an acclaimed stage actor who was knighted for his work 8 years prior to this. That rarely happened to film actors in those days. Despite his pedigree, he does show up in quite a few Universal lower A and actual B pictures like this, the remake of Hunchback of Notre Dame, The Invisible Man Returns, and Invisible Agent. He always brings that haughty air of sophistication to the proceedings. He's somewhat like a more detached Claude Rains in that way.
Yeah.
And that's something that struck me as like, you know, they ported everybody else over from the Wolfman. What if Claude Rains played Ludwig Frankenstein? I kind of like, I'm not, nothing against Sir Cedric Hardwick, but I just really like Claude Rains.
Yeah.
And he's definitely got more universe. He was the Invisible Man.
Right.
He's Sir John Talbot. You know, he's just, you know, I just, it'd be interesting to have seen him play some Dr. Frankenstein. Dr. Kettering is played by Barton Yarborough, who had great success in radio in the I Love a Mystery and Dragnet series. He appeared in the I Love a Mystery film series as well, and he filmed two episodes of the original Jack Webb Dragnet TV series before falling ill and dying at a very young age. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so he was, I guess, Joe Friday, one of his original partners. So, of course, Dr. Bulmer is played by Lionel Atwell, who we have discussed quite often on this series. He's usually either a good-hearted official or a scheming mad scientist in these films, so guess which one he is this time.
Mm-hmm.
Fits right in. The three doctors had just removed a brain, repaired it, and replaced it. That might come in handy later. Just saying. So how did the monster get so cleaned up when he came to this?
Stopped at a creek, by the way.
Stopped at a creek. Igor know of car wash, me take you to.
Yeah. Or maybe they just couldn't stand that sulfur smell and they dunked him in it. I mean, seriously, dunked him in a river to get rid of it.
Yeah, maybe so. I love Lon Chaney Jr. Everyone who follows this series knows that. He's been featured in every House of Frankenstein series. The Wolfman is my favorite Universal monster, and Larry Talbot is my favorite character in these movies. Mm-hmm. I still subscribe to that. He is the linchpin. He is the protagonist of them overall, if you look at them together. But I will say, I feel like Chaney's monster portrayal is much more limited and less nuanced than Karloff's. Now, that's probably due to the script and the direction, at least partially, but when Igor and the monster enter into Visaria, a gaggle of geese walk between them. There's this young girl that's like, you know, herding geese.
Yeah.
And I feel like if that had been Karloff, we would have got some kind of like either like a playful reaction to it, like, you know, or you know, that type of thing. He never even in this movie, he never utters a sound
until
the end when it's not him. Chaney seems like the monster is in sleep mode, except for a few instances through this. It fits the script and him being, like, downpowered, but I miss that humanity of the monster that Karloff let peek through.
Right.
And we lost some of that in Son of, because he was more like Igor's blunt instrument of destruction. But there were those moments, like when he touched, you know, he touched Wolf's face and then looked at himself in the mirror. And, of course, then when he screamed and when he thought Igor was dead, he was dead. But, you know, but yeah, I just missed that. And then the monster meets little Cloistine, who is not at all afraid of him, unlike the other kids. And you had little Maria worries.
I'm like, don't you hurt her. Don't you hurt her. Don't you hurt her. Don't mean it. Don't hurt her. Don't. I just kept saying it the whole time. I was like,
she's an even smaller kid. She looks like she's about four.
Yeah,
or five.
Yeah.
I think the filmmakers were playing on that here because that scene was already infamous by that time. And I think by this time they'd already edited that scene. I mean, they edited out the monster throwing her into the lake,
yeah,
the pond, lake, whatever. And that, and like some people brought up, that actually makes things worse because you don't know what he did to her.
Yeah.
You know, you just see, know that he, you see the dad later carrying her. It's like, well, what did he do to her?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, did he intentionally hurt her? You know, so it's like, yeah, but that scene was already infamous by this time. I know her father is frightened, but why didn't he climb up there and try to get at her? I mean, at least he stops the guy from shooting at him, I guess, because it's,
but, I mean, I thought about that because at the time I'm like, go up there and get your kid. But at the same time, he probably saw that other guy already going up there.
Yeah.
And he might be like, you know, I'm not going to spook him. I'm not going to spook, you know.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
So
the monster kills the guys on the stairs with one blow because it seems like he dies when he hits him and then he just falls down the stairs and then he knocks the other guy just off the roof.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you look at the trailer for the film, it shows that scene without the close-up inserted, and it's very obvious the monster was really telegraphing that swing. So that's another thing. Editing saves movies, you know. Right. Janet Ann Gallo, who played Cloistine, is still with us and makes convention appearances to this day, or she did back when conventions were going on. She said Chaney was wonderful to the child actors, buying them ice cream and keeping them entertained, and he was so smitten with Gallo when her mother passed away.
Mm-hmm.
He actually asked her father if he would allow her and her brother to be adopted by him and his wife. Chaney and his wife wanted to adopt her and her brother.
And her little brother was like 2 or 3 at the time.
Yeah, they were very young. And, of course, the father said no. But back then, I mean, that sounds like, well, why would you want to give up your kid? But back then, a
single father was just unheard of, especially keeping children that age.
Yeah, yeah, right. You know, right. So yeah. But she has nothing but wonderful things to
like
say.
Like she
about
said, it was nice to be wanted.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, of course, with their income, they could provide anything for the children.
Right.
You know, so. It takes the entire town to contain the monster, and he's not even at full strength, which, you know, I said the police in the synopsis, but it's really like the entire town, like, dog piles on him.
Yeah.
So, we then meet Elsa Frankenstein.
I still say, I think naming her Elsa Frankenstein is a nod to Elsa Lancaster.
It might be.
I mean, just the name.
Yeah, it might be, yeah. She's played by Universal Scream Queen Evelyn Anchors, who we have discussed in The Wolfman, The Son of Dracula, and her beau, Eric Ernst, played by Ralph Bellamy, also from The Wolfman, but known to more modern audiences as one of the Duke brothers in Trading Places, along with Don Ameche, you know. Mm-hmm. Or so everybody remembers those two guys. And they later show up in Coming to America as in they're down on their luck in the street, remember?
Yeah.
It says a lot about Igor that he was announced by the maid, but he is still lurking behind the curtains when Ludwig goes into the room there.
The study there,
yeah. The study. He just likes being creepy, even if he doesn't have to. You know, that's Igor's thing, you know. It's interesting that Ludwig apparently recognizes Igor, but Wolf didn't.
Right.
So I wonder if Ludwig stayed in Europe while Wolf left the continent, and so Ludwig was more aware of his father's dealings with Igor and his experiments and... Because we didn't see Igor in the previous Frankenstein films with Colin Clive.
Right.
So you have to think he was either behind the scenes or he did stuff for him after the fact that, you know, there were other things that Heinrich Henry Frankenstein, not Victor in these films, did that we don't know about. So But like you said, why did Ludwig keep the name Frankenstein?
Right, if he didn't want to know, didn't want to be attached, and he'd moved to this area at least, say, 25 years ago, minimum.
Yeah.
You know.
Peter Cushing usually changes his name when he goes into other towns as Baron Frankenstein. Right,
and they had to be close enough. Well, you don't know how long they traveled, but,
yeah,
you know, they were able to get there probably on foot.
Yeah.
So.
Of course, Lugosi continues to shine as Igor. He seems so simple-minded, but he's deviously cunning. He knows how to put the screws mm-hmm. to anyone. I mean, he's, like, got their number from the get-go.
Yeah.
That's what's so, I mean, he's so, I mean, he looks like a wreck. But, yeah, you know, it's like he's just so crafty. He's great. So, did Wolf send his and Heinrich's journals to Ludwig? I mean, if so, why? Why didn't he just burn them?
Exactly. I've never figured that out. You know, if you've got something you don't want, you know, he's got it hidden and stuff like that, but... You know, burn the stuff. Or even, you know, if Wolf didn't burn him, why didn't Ludwig, who was ashamed of it, why didn't he burn it?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, maybe from Ludwig's perspective, there was some kind of medical reason to keep it, you know? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Like, maybe he thought there could be some good come out of it if you didn't, like, try to actually reanimate a corpse, you know, corpses or, I don't know. In the courtroom at the door, you can see some kids. One of them making his film debut is actor William Smith, who recently passed away, unfortunately. But he had a long career as a tough guy character actor in movies like Any Which Way You Can and TV series like Laredo. And he voiced Draga in the Justice League episode War World. He was great. And, of course, the episode was not.
Yeah.
As anybody listens to our Justice League, our JLU cast will know. Worst episode of Justice League. Not his fault. He's great in it.
Yes.
So. But yeah, he's a young little boy here. He's right. You can see him right when Cloystein walks in. He's standing right next to her. I feel like there's a lot of Chaney's Lenny from Of Mice and Men in his portrayal of the monster. He's either completely placid or enraged.
Mm-hmm.
So like Lenny, he also loves small innocent things like Cloystein. He smiles when she enters the courtroom.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a, you know, it's a very... Like, it's not a, it's a very limited smile, though, even more so than, like, Karloff would do. The Karloff's monster would actually, like, you know, smoke, you know, and have, like, look actually.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was the direction or Chaney's choice or, but it's almost like every time, it's almost like every time the monster dies and comes back, he's less human or something.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, kind of like how.
Grundy.
Changes personalities Solomon and stuff Grundy. Every time. Yeah.
Solomon Grundy! Don't invoke him. He'll come in.
So, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
sorry.
So we don't need him interrupting right now.
That's right.
It's interesting that Hussman does bring up that the townspeople reneged on not harming the monster in the courtroom. He's
right.
Like, he's like, you nearly beat him to death after you said you wouldn't hurt him.
Yeah.
So, Ludwig states he never saw this man before in my life. And as far as we know, that's true unless the monster and his father were reunited at some point that we weren't aware of.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, the monster recognizes a Frankenstein when he sees one, even if there's no actual resemblance between Colin Clive, Basil Rathbone, or Cedric Hardwick. So
he just knows.
He's got Frankenstein dar. I don't know. Igor playing the horn to lure the monster away is lifted a bit from Son of Frankenstein, but definitely influences the Igor monster connection in Young Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, most of it's from the first three, but there's a little bit of this one in Young Frankenstein too. So what did you think of Elsa's flame dress?
Her gowns are so lovely.
Well, and you know,
I mean, I love that era of fashion.
Even Lankers is a nice looking woman too.
Well, so. She is, but you know, before the United States went into war rationing and things like that, that was before, you know,
yeah,
this was filmed before. So you had a lot of sumptuousness. You had a lot of, you know, elaborateness and the hairdos and all that stuff. And, I mean, the fashion was so lovely.
Yeah, and apparently her gowns were by Vera West.
Huh?
So there you go, yeah. We get some flashbacks to the original Frankenstein with Colin Clive, who unfortunately died of illness and alcoholism in 1937. And Dwight Frye plays Fritz here, so he's playing two roles in this movie, actually. That's Karloff on the lab table, but when the bandages are removed from his face, it's the much heftier Lon Chaney Jr.
Right.
And that was super gaunt. I'm starving, Boris Karloff, in the first Frankenstein. So, Igor peeking over the monster's shoulder in the window makes him look like a peeping Tom. I think that, I've seen stills of that, and it's almost kind of funny. It's not meant to be, but he's got that ooh look on his face.
So. Right. And it's so weird when he meets with Ludwig, and then he's saying, you know, he waves to Elsa when he leaves, that creepy, you know, way.
Yeah, I mean, he is a creeper. That's for sure. There's something very unsettling about Igor. Everything's unsettling about Igor. So the monster busts in into the lab. Why did he just kill Kettering? I mean, he didn't walk into Viseria and start murdering everyone. Was it because Igor got him worked up that Frankenstein was inside? I mean, he's like, Frankenstein's inside, you know, and all this.
I don't know.
He seems to hesitate harming his creator each time. The monster has gotten randomly murderous before. The old woman in the well in Bride of Frankenstein, for instance. I mean, he just knocks her right in at the beginning of the movie. Of course, he just got burned alive, so he's kind of pissed, but... but it's usually provoked in some fashion like that. So not doesn't make it right, but I'm just saying. It's just odd that he just like he kills him just right off the bat and then drags his body around. So what did you think of Ludwig running into the lab and leaving Elsa out there with him when he turned the gas on?
I know. I'm like, dude.
I mean, it was the smart thing to do, but it's not necessarily very heroic or even very fatherly.
No. Just like,
well, I'm hoping you're going to be okay, but I'm going
to
turn this...
Because if it's strong enough to take out the monster, then it might kill you, you know? Right. Think about how much he had to pump in there.
Yeah, yeah. It's odd we never see any other patients in the asylum or the mental hospital. Had this been a Hammer film, we'd gotten to know a lot of them there because Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell actually takes place in an asylum. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's kind of what made me think of. The monster comes to on the lab table and tries to reach for Ludwig, so maybe he would have harmed him. I don't know. Notice they don't show him actually injecting him.
No.
They show him get the needle, and they show him, like, they cut away. It's probably against the codes of the time.
That's what I was thinking, you know.
No sedative. Sedative? Oh, sorry. Young Frankenstein reference. But they will let him talk about dissection.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're good. Well, you can cut him apart bit by bit and show a brain later, but we can't show nobody getting a needle. I mean, people get, you know,
shots all the time.
Not enough people get shots all the time, but oh, I'm sorry. the titular ghost of Heinrich Frankenstein is played by Hardwick here, too. Of course, like we said, Colin Clive had passed away. So, do you think his father's ghost is actually there, or is this all in Ludwig's mind?
Oh, it's in his head.
Think so?
And I think he's dealt with, you know, the mentally ill for so long that it might have affected his thought processes and stuff like that.
Mm.
How he sees the world.
That's a good angle. I hadn't thought of that. I don't really know. I don't know how to take it. I mean, I do kind of feel like it's more that what would my father do type thing, you know. Don't listen to that guy. Why is everybody hung up? That guy was an asshole. I'm sorry. I mean, just, you know.
Right.
I mean, he was a nut. It just... Stop it already. The ghost effect is really well done, though. It's very blurry and ethereal, and it just kind of floats from place to place in the lab. I thought it was nicely done. So I think Ludwig's descent into monster mania is the most altruistic of his family in this series because, like I said, Henry was obsessed.
Yeah.
Then he rejected everything, got lured back in by Pretorius, who, of course, blackmailed him with his kidnapped wife. And everything. And then Wolf was determined to prove the haters wrong and save the family name.
Right.
Which, of course, is part of what Ludwig wants to do. He wants to turn a negative into a positive and also save Kettering. Sure, there's that family pride involved, but he is probably the most pure of heart with this. And he's the one that dies.
Yeah.
Henry Frankenstein's supposed to die in the first one. Didn't die. Got saved. Shown... obviously dead, and they film a tacked-on scene with a different actor in a bed to say, oh, he lived.
Mm-hmm.
Then Henry Frankenstein in The Bride, they show him in the lab when it blows up, but then they film a scene with them running away at the end, him and Elizabeth. And then, of course, Wolf, just he gets to leave town in a train with his wife and son.
Yeah.
But poor Ludwig, who's the least jerk of them all, has to die.
Yeah.
You brought up a good point. Why wasn't Igor locked up?
Yeah, he's a bad guy. Come on.
He's instigating all this. You know, it's like, it's not like he's just some random dude that showed up. He brought all this on him, you know. He just walks out of his room and into the lab area. I mean, they had the lab locked, but he could have went up into the house.
Exactly.
And they already know he's been creepy to Elsa.
Yeah.
So, Kitten telegraphs the finale a bit when Igor is trying to convince Ludwig to give the monster his brain and not Kettering's. The camera goes over to Atwell as Bulmer, and he's framed in a circular antenna of some kind. Yeah. So talking like, it's like, it's pretty obvious, but it's kind of cool that he did that. So there's some artful choices in this movie that are cool. Like when they really do a good job of making Chaney look like a freaking giant to Janet Ann Gallo. I mean, she looks like she's like 2 inches tall to him. I mean, the angles that they use over his shoulder and underneath her looking up at him are really effective. Yeah. It does make you wonder why Ludwig has just the right machinery for monster making, though, doesn't it? I mean, Kenneth Strickfaden had a closeout sale. So, Elsa, of course, acts as Ludwig's conscience, telling him he's not acting as himself. But compared to the other Frankenstein, he seems very much sane. I mean, the rest of them are all like, Colin Clive was a wreck all the time. And Basil Rathbone got all, uppity pissed off at everybody when he was, like, working on the monster and everything. Yeah. Especially Krogh, who just kept coming around. So Igor is trying to convince the monster this new brain thing is a good thing, and he's on board.
That's what gets me. I'm like, dude, it's not a share thing. No.
I know he's dim-witted, but he doesn't seem to realize he'll cease to exist.
Yeah. I'm like, dude.
Yeah. The later films get very loose with the whole brain thing from characters who should know better, particularly House of Frankenstein, but at least here, really, only the monster isn't aware that his personality goes away with the brain. Brain ain't in a body, you ain't nobody. It's like you're dead, but
I ain't got nobody. Nobody.
Igor again.
Sorry.
How does Igor know about Bulmer and Ludwig's former mentor people?
See, that's what I mean, he knew where to go to find him, so maybe he just kept track of the Frankensteins?
I think he had a blackmail file cabinet in the sulfur pit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Look under B for Bulmer. Oh, yes, I see he was discredited. Ah, ha, ha, I'll use this against him. I think Bulmer gets the monster mania more than Ludwig in this one. Sure, he was bitter about his treatment, but to go along with giving an obvious scum like Igor unlimited strength and power just to be like the head of the local medical community, that's like...
But the thing is I think it was all, the biggest thing was not necessarily making himself look good, but making Frankenstein look bad.
Good point, yeah.
I think that was more,
Go work for somebody else, dude. I mean, if you're that bitter, leave,
Yeah.
Elsa walks away when Eric comes in and brings up Dr. Kettering and her father's lies. She is struggling going along with all this. I like that. She turns her back and walks away when they start talking about Kettering. That's a nice touch. Like you said, at least Eric and the police aren't dumb in this one.
I know.
They were actually on the right track, but Igor and the monster just happened to have left.
Yeah, I mean, they found the secret room,
Yeah.
Figured out how to open it.
Yep. So how did the monster know where Cloistine lived? That connection? He's got some kind of...
Well, I wonder if he didn't have, maybe heightened sense of smell or something. I don't know.
Kind of maybe. After all that sulfur up his nose, how could he? But I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, he is the wolf man too, so.
Well, That's true. She's not freaked out at all, even though this giant.
And I'm sorry, but if you wake me up in the middle of the night, I'm like, whoa!
Yeah, if I wake you up in the middle of the night, you do that.
I know. And what about when Danny, think about this, when Danny was little, our daughter used to sleepwalk, and ever so often, you'd wake up, you'd
save
wake
that up, one story for the. Our last episode this year.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, sometimes you'd wake up and she would come and stand at the door. And you think about it, she was tiny. So her face would be like right in my face. I'd turn and open my eyes and look over. And there would be this little 4 or 5 year old little kid just looking at you. And she wouldn't be seeing anything. You talk about almost peeing your pants.
A lot of times she just, once you woke up, she'd just walk away and go back and get in bed.
Yeah. I mean, oh.
It's kind of creepy. Yeah, it was.
Yeah, which is why we put the bell on her door.
Yeah. She was just like Peter last time. It's like, a big giant came in, with his southern accent. Yep. Yes. He was a mascot. He picks the monster, picks her up, blankets and all, and she stays like that for the remainder of the film.
I know, because, you know, later on, and it's like 2 weeks later, she's still in the blanket. So she's just wrapped up like a little burrito.
Yep, yep. He goes back to get her ball, but he knocks over an oil lamp.
Yeah.
So that's where the fire starts. He did start the fire. When they return, Bomer... Bomer says Ludwig was half mad, but Hardwick never really plays him that Mm-mm. way. I wonder if that was in the script and maybe he disagreed with that direction and did his own thing, trying to make Ludwig seem a little more noble, or doesn't match, you know. And really, when Elsa was like, "You're not the same. You know, you seem to be acting like differently." It's like, well, does he really? I mean, he seems a little nervous, but like I said, compared to the other guys, he really doesn't. So. Even Igor tells Bomer he couldn't stop him when he wanted to leave. He does try to tell him if he wants Cloystein's brain, it will kill her. But lovingly tells him, tonight Igor will die for you.
But the thing is, Igor is really not the person who's dying. It would be Frankenstein.
It would be the monster, yeah. Yeah. The creaking sound effects of snapping wood when he... closes the door with Igor behind it. That really sells that he's being crushed
right
by the door. But I did notice the wooden horn on his back.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
Did not shatter, which it should have, obviously. That would have been a good sign to show it, like, drop to the floor.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, man, he really crushed him, you know. So why does the monster want the little girl's brain? That's the number one question in this movie. Thoughts?
I honestly think it's one of those cases he wants to be innocent. And what's more innocent than a little child? So, and I mean, he doesn't realize that therefore takes, you know, gets rid of him. He's just thinking about that innocence.
He literally thinks like they're going to be in the two brains are going to be in the same skull. Of course, he doesn't realize he'll die and then she'll just be in his old body either. So it's just really odd.
It is. I wonder why. I don't know.
Yeah. Elsa takes the girl away, and then Ludwig leads the monster to the lab with the ball, and I'm assuming the monster thought he was still going to get Cloystein's brain.
Yeah.
So, did Ludwig know Igor was dead? I mean, what do you think? I mean, wouldn't he have wondered where he was that night of the experiment, or at least where he went for the two weeks
right. afterwards? Right, you know, because he would think he'd be, you know, here's this guy, he really wanted his brain, I didn't do it, so surely he should be in here badgering me about it.
Right, I mean, Bomer told him, so, oh, he, you know, the monster killed him, and I, you know, and they didn't, don't bother looking at his skull. It's like, why has his skull been opened and then reattached? Oh, don't pay attention to that.
Yeah, so, don't worry about it.
Ludwig asks, what would Kettering think? How do you think he would react if Kettering had actually, his brain had been put in the monster and he woke up in that body?
Oh, I'm trying to think. In Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein, okay?
Yeah.
Okay. In Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein, they take and put his fiance's brain or his wife's brain, I can't remember exactly, in the cadaver.
Yeah.
And
it's down the bottom corner.
Right. But she actually takes an oil lamp and crushes it above her head and burns herself up. Like, how could you do this to me? I think that would be the same reaction from any person.
Yeah.
I think that's what would happen. How could you do this
Especially,
to me?
Especially, those monsters were so hideous in those films. Yeah. And there's a Hammer movie, Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed, where a good person is put in the brains are switched, and of course the surgery's, I mean, he's not hideous looking, but he's got a humongous scar and stitches and everything, and it's the reaction's like the same, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, what have you done to me, that type of thing. Yeah. So yeah,
I just remember, I mean, that's the scene from the movie that sticks in my head.
I need to watch that again. I haven't seen that in a long, long time. I remember not being
Maybe
like...
Maybe we ought to do that for House of Frankenstein next year.
Yeah, we still got to do the original Frankenstein. We've never done that, believe it or not. That's the one Universal Frankenstein
really?
Movie we haven't done.
I thought
that.
We had.
No, we did Brides to start out with.
Oh.
We didn't do Frankenstein for some reason.
For some reason, I don't know, because I guess they're right together. I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah. Husband says, which is Cloystein's brother, says it's been 2 weeks. I think this movie works better if it wasn't quite that long, but he says it.
I know. I mean, to me, they should have just said
it's been a
time
few days.
Passed or, you know.
Yeah, it's 2 weeks is a little too long, especially with her being in that house. We'll get to that. But it's just, I don't get it. Harry Cording plays Frone, the villager who gets the mob going in Visaria, along with Hussman. He played in several Universal classics, including The Black Cat with Lugosi and Karloff. So, I think Ralph Bellamy has on Basil Rathbone's two-tone jacket from Son of Frankenstein in the climax.
I thought so.
It's not a two-tone Ricky Ricardo jacket.
No.
And he doesn't have an autographed picture of Andy Devine, but, you know, that's okay. But Lon Chaney Jr. will have a pencil-thin mustache. And actually, so does Sedgwick Hardwick. So, there you go. little Jimmy Buffett for you there. I was
wondering where you were going with that. I didn't catch it right at first. Oh, okay. Sorry.
I love how the mob won't even wait for Eric to come back out. What else do they have to do? Watch the hay grow? I mean, what do they do with that tail? He ain't come back out yet, but let's get started anyway. I do think it's refreshing that Ludwig is willing to come clean with Eric.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like, okay, I'll tell you now. Of course, he's been duped, but he doesn't know that.
Right.
So, the look on Chaney's face is completely different with Igor's mind.
Yes, that's really well done.
Yeah, his mind in the body of the monster, he has a sly, evil grin even before he starts to speak. He mm-hmm. nods his head when he asks him if he knows who he is. And he's enjoying toying with Ludwig.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, I feel like, okay, this is Lon Chaney Jr. finally acting in this film. Mm-hmm. Being allowed to act in
right.
this film at the end. Bulmer looks really pleased with himself, too. Yeah, I think that's where your theory comes in. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was more about sticking it to Frankenstein.
Yep.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, because he's definitely got that look on his face. It is a great reveal when the monster speaks with Lugosi's voice. Even Joe Dante in one of the special features, one of the documentaries, says it's actually chilling, you know.
Yeah.
It actually works. A lot of times when they'll do that, it doesn't work. I mean, even I really enjoyed Superman and Lois season one, but the finale of that with Jordan talking with whatever the old Kryptonian evil fart dude's name is, I can't think.
Right.
That was kind of You know, it looked a little silly, honestly, at times. This works.
Yeah.
This really works. Yeah. Eric just leaves Ludwig in there with these two nuts.
Yeah.
He's like, I can't clear you now or something like that. And he like locks the door behind him and leaves his future father-in-law in there with the monster and this obviously evil mad scientist.
Yeah. Well, you know. It's like, okay.
Now I'm going to get you all your money. So it's all mine. You don't have nothing left that they burned the place down, but. I wonder what Elsa would think if she knew that. I wonder if that ever comes up. I doubt it.
Yeah.
Oh, honey, I meant to tell you, that time, you know, when your father died and your house blew up, I left him in there with them, you know?
Yeah!
We've got four kids now. We've been married for 20 years, you whole boy, Elsa. What's wrong with you? I failed to mention the sets of the house look to be the same as Talbot Manor. In The Wolfman, yes. Another thing, it's like, where's Claude Rains? You know. Elsa gets Cloistine and hands her to her father. She's still wrapped in those blankets.
I know! 2 weeks later!
So what was their plan? I mean, were they going to keep her until they could announce the reformed Kettering monster combo to the world? I mean,
and what about the little girl? Didn't she wonder why she was there? And then, wouldn't she, you know.
Why did Elsa go along with this?
Yeah.
She even says when the monster brings in, please take me home. You know.
Yeah.
It's like, take the little girl home. Make up something. It's like, oh, she doesn't know what she's talking about. She's a little kid, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, that didn't happen. You know, she just wandered into our house, you know, or something. I mean, you know, why kidnap her for 2 weeks? It's just, ugh. Eric tells Elsa he'll go back for Ludwig, but then why did he leave him?
In the first place.
Yeah. So is Eric just resistant to gas or something? Because he runs back into the gas that everyone else is running from. Elsa faints, but he just keeps going. Is it because he's the heroic lead?
Let's go with that.
I guess so, yeah. Chaney wrecks that set much like he often did his own dressing room.
Yeah.
So him and Roderick Crawford get in a fight and get kicked out of their dressing rooms. And so... The instant flash fire when that rack of chemicals...
Oh, it was. It was a nice...
Yeah, boy, it comes up quick. Yeah. And now Chaney must add burn makeup to his list of sufferings for this film, on top of his Frankenstein monster makeup. So, the monster being crushed by the burning debris is reused in the climax of House of Dracula, which we covered here, even though he's played there by Glenn Strange.
Mm-hmm.
So the romantic music stirs, and Eric and Elsa walk up the hill away from her burning home to see the sun rising. A new day will come with her father dead, her name ruined, and her up on kidnapping charges. But at least they have love. it's just that abrupt universal ending. Yeah. It's like, there's so much wrong. It's like, her life is ruined.
Yeah.
And he's probably, Eric's probably ruined too, because the town's like, you're in love with that chick? Her family's evil. You guys get the hell out of town, you know? So, yeah, it's, Elsa Frankenstein will return in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, but not played by Evelyn Ankers, but Ilona Massey, who is far more Germanic. Doesn't even seem like the same character, but she's got the same name. So. And of course, originally the monster was to remain blind with Igor's brain in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman as it was filmed, but depending on who you believe, it was either edited to eliminate the Igor angle, either for it seeming silly or because Universal felt audiences wouldn't stand for someone with a European accent talking about world domination with a world war raging on at the time. But either way, poor Bela Lugosi was made to look the fool in his first and only outing as a monster, which is a real shame.
Yeah.
And I, you know, that is, of course, one of the major wishes, and we talked about that when we covered this movie, of any monster fan, is let's hopefully find London After Midnight with Lon Chaney Sr. and hope they find the uncut version of Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman.
Right.
So we can finally see what Lugosi would have done as a monster with his playing blind and it being referenced that he's blind and also being able to speak. So, Chaney would return to the role briefly in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, subbing in scenes for an injured Glenn Strange. And in a non-Universal adaptation, that was the live Tales of Tomorrow TV series that broadcast a Frankenstein episode with Chaney as the monster. But unfortunately, Chaney's alcoholism, he was so drunk when they filmed that live, he believed it was a dress rehearsal, and only picked up the pieces of furniture and pieces of the set he was supposed to wreck live on camera and put them gently back down because he thought it was a dress rehearsal.
Right, and he wanted them there for later.
Yeah, and it was apparently a big disaster. So he did play the monster once again with Abbott and Costello on the Colgate Comedy Hour as well. Mm-hmm. So what did you think of this one?
Oh, I mean, I liked it. I mean, it's a nice continuation. There are, you know, some problems, which we talked about, but it is a nice installment to the series.
Right. I mean, this is obviously the start of the B feel to the movies, although it's still got a bit of that A prestige about it. The semi-nonsensical brain swapping begins here, though, and that really drags the films down, despite them all being a lot of fun.
Yeah, exactly.
The movies just get a little more juvenile, I feel like. I would argue that Chaney gets more screen time than Karloff did last time, but as we pointed out, no one could top Karloff in that role, but as Karloff worried, the monster was indeed becoming more of a prop than a character.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Chaney showed, it is unfortunate, the original intention of Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman was to have Chaney play both the monster and the Wolfman.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, you know, use body doubles when they needed to, stuntmen, et cetera. They decided they, you know, the breakneck speed they made these movies on, and they got even quicker as they went into B mode. They didn't end up doing that. And I'm assuming Lugosi would have remained to do the voiceover,
right?
As the creature. But they didn't do that. But the real thing about this movie is the monster that we have followed from the first movie is dead.
Yeah,
his brain is gone. And the monster we meet from now on in the remaining four movies
is Igor.
If you count Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Although he does talk again in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, he does not sound like Igor. He sounds like Glenn Strange. So he doesn't sound like Bela Lugosi. Of course, Bela Lugosi is there because he's Dracula. So and so is Lon Chaney because he's a Wolfman. So this is the end of the original Frankenstein monster in this film. So it's kind of a weird, odd way to go with a franchise if you think about it. But it's fun. I like it. It's probably the least of the ones so far, but it's I like elements of Frankenstein Meet the Wolfman better. I like all the Wolfman stuff in it better, but the Frankenstein stuff in this one's better. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
But it's a lot of fun. So if you haven't seen it in a while, definitely go check it out. They're always fun. But this one's fun. And Lugosi's great as Igor. So we'll take a quick break and we'll come back and we'll visit the comic crypt and pull out a spooky comic with Frankenstein in it.
Greetings, guys and ghouls. I'm the Invisible Dan Colon, and this is The Monsters That Made Us. Join Monster Mike Manzi and I on the last Friday of every month as we celebrate all of the spooktacular characters and films in the Universal Studios Classic Monster series. From the Phantom of the Opera to The Creature Walks Among Us, we sink our teeth into all the gory details as we dissect the films that gave us some of the most iconic movie monsters of all time. The Monsters That Made Us is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For more information, head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
It's Citizen Kane Minute. Hosted by film fanatic Rob Kelly and a collection of special guests, Citizen Kane Minute will examine the greatest film of all time, 5 minutes at a time. Coming soon to the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Okay, we're back, and we have crept into the comic crypt in the House of Frankenstein and have picked out Uncanny X-Men Volume 1, Number 40, from January 1968, although it was on sale November 9th, 1967, right after Halloween of 1967.
Of course.
I might add, yes. On the cover by George Tuska, the hulking figure of the Frankenstein monster waits on the other side of a door inside the metal hull of a ship. As the monster crunches a piece of metal of the metal wall waiting for his prey, the X-Men, Beast, Cyclops, Iceman, Marvel Girl, and the Angel approach. The text blurb reads, "The X-Men meet Frankenstein, nuff said," and we learn the title of the story is Mark of the Monster. What did you think of this cover?
I honestly thought, oh my, what are they going to do to the Frankenstein story? I mean, that was my first thought, and I was not disappointed by that thought. So,
telegraphing a little, it's, yeah.
Yeah,
the monster here is sporting grayish-purple skin, rocking a green jacket and pants, and an orange shirt. He does have a fairly flat head with some neck bolts, so he's infringing on the Universal copyright design some, but I guess they'd look the other way. I do love his off-model moccasin boots, however, on the cover.
Mm.
That's he's very fashion trendy. It was hippies time.
Oh, yeah, true.
There's a lot of detail on the monster, but the X-Men, the actual stars of the book, they kind of look phoned in. I don't think George Tuska cared much for drawing superheroes, so maybe he spent more time on the more interesting monster.
Mm-hmm, most definitely. They're there, but they're not popping.
Like Bugs Bunny said, monsters are such interesting people, you know. Mark of the Monster was written by Roy Thomas with pencils by Don Heck, inks by George Tuska. Artie Simic did the letters, and Stan the Man Lee was the editor.
Inside their danger room at the Xavier School for Gifted Youngsters, the other male X-Men members watch the Beast go through a series of obstacles. But Iceman decides to play a prank on the verbose Beast, who, as a result, is blasted by a force beam. Before Beast can repay the favor, the entire team, including Marvel Girl, is summoned to the side of their leader, Professor X. He tells the team of a recent Arctic expedition which uncovered the frozen remains of a creature he believes to be none other than the Frankenstein monster.
Xavier relates how the monster jumped into the Arctic Ocean after the death of his creator in Mary Shelley's original novel. He believes that the monster is in fact an android, and that perhaps his creator was actually a mutant possessing a highly advanced brain, enabling him to create such a being. He wants to study the monster to determine his origins and prevent the New York City Museum from thawing out the creature and releasing a monster on the world.
At that museum, the expedition head, Dr. Powell, is ahead of Charles Xavier and begins thawing out the creature. The X-Men, in their civilian guises of Scott Summers, Jean Grey, Hank McCoy, Bobby Drake, and Warren Worthington III, arrive. And after Jean uses her powers to subdue a guard, head inside, only to hear a horrible ruckus. They change into their fighting uniforms and find the rather chatty monster wrecking the lab inside. The monster seems to have a history with humans in brightly colored costume and attacks the heroes. He somehow absorbs Cyclops' optic blast and redirects them back at him. The monster takes out the entire team, save for Iceman, who stays back at Xavier's insistence. The monster escapes, and the young mutants head after him.
With the Angel scouting ahead, the team tracks the monster to New York Harbor in a recently launched freighter. Using a helicopter they borrowed from the Pan Am building, the heroes land on the boat and make quick work of the sailors defending their ship. They get permission from the frightened captain to come aboard and begin their search for the monster. The Beast is the first to encounter the creature and lures him out into the open, where Angel lassos him with a hoist. But the clever monster uses even stranger abilities to magnetize his feet, making it impossible for the team to lift him. Cyclops and Marvel Girl fare no better in stopping him, so Professor X uses his mental powers to beckon the creature to him. Using telekinesis, he blocks the monster from striking him, while Iceman is finally allowed to begin his attack.
He sprays the monster repeatedly with his ice powers, and the paralyzed creature yells out that cold is his only weakness. The monster strains against the growing ice, and at the last second, Xavier orders Iceman to throw up a shield around the others before the monster explodes, proving that he was indeed a mechanical being. Professor X explains he was able to probe the monster's mind in his last moments and learn that he had been built by aliens from a tropical planet and sent to Earth as an ambassador 150 years ago. Xavier surmises something went wrong with the android's programming, causing him to go berserk and become the menace known in myth and legend. Due to his creation in tropical temperatures, the monster could not withstand the Arctic cold or Iceman's blast. Xavier can only wonder how Mary Shelley learned of all of this, and Winnie can only wonder what drugs they were using in the Marvel offices in late 67.
So what did you think of this one?
Hi-ya.
Can you enunciate further on that?
Holy macaroni. I mean, wow.
I have not read a lot of X-Men from this period, and honestly, I don't think I'm in a hurry to after this one either, I'll be honest.
Oh my golly, I mean,
it's fun and entertaining, but man, there are some leaps of logic here that Beast couldn't even make.
No, I mean, you know, and he even, the big Xavier, when he's probing him, he's like, well, he doesn't have a brain, then how was he able to...
He wasn't able to probe him before, but now all of a sudden he's able to probe him.
Yeah, I don't understand that. You create a world and you set the rules of your world and you don't just change them up willy-nilly.
Yeah, by the end of the story, just to wrap things up.
Yeah.
We keep saying Xavier. I think usually they say Xavier, but I mean, yeah, you know, around here we've got in Ohio Xavier University, mm-hmm. so, but you know, usually I think in the movies they say Xavier, so mm. I mean, so it can be either way, and I think Andy Leyland says Xavier, you know, sometimes. So it's like, you know, it's just according to how you're...
Where you're at.
Where you're at, yeah. So we start out in the Danger Room, which is a good place to start any X-Men story. Obviously, Roy Thomas is trying to evoke some Human Torch thing rivalry feels with Iceman and Beast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which, you know, the X-Men were basically a teenage version of the... all-teenage version of the Fantastic Four, more or less, at this point. Jean and Professor X are cagey about what they're doing, and given that early on Chuck had a thing for Jean in the comics, which was later retconned into that whole Onslaught deal, one might wonder what is going on.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, Thomas is setting up an event that will occur in two issues where Xavier seemingly dies.
Hmm.
Turns out this was all a ruse by Chuck to prepare for some alien invasion or something, but that isn't revealed for over a year. He stays dead for like over a year in the comics.
Hmm.
This one of many times that they've written Xavier out of the book only to bring him back later. So why was Charles so sure that the novel actually chronicled real events? And even if so, what made him think the monster was an android?
The only reason that you could possibly give for this, because comics. I'm sorry, but what?
I think that the android part partially stems from the comics code. Because at this time, comics couldn't even use the real Frankenstein monster because he was essentially a revenant.
Mm-hmm.
He was an undead creature. He was the dead risen from the grave. So humor books got away with it. Like, you know, Bob Hope and different comedy books of the time. Jerry Lewis could show a Frankenstein monster and things like that. But straight comics couldn't use him. So hence, he's a robot. I think that has something to do with it. They could literally not use, like, vampires or...
Okay.
Or werewolves or Frankenstein. They couldn't use zombies at this time. So I get thinking that Victor Frankenstein may have been a mutant due to his brilliance. But as we see, he didn't even create this monster, you know.
And I'm like, well, where did that part come from? And where's Mary Shelley? And it's just like, you know, they just shoved it into that story.
I mean, we did that story last year where Batman and Robin went in the past and found out where the real story of Frankenstein came from that inspired Mary Shelley. And that's an old Golden Age story, and it makes more sense than this does.
I know. And that's saying something.
Yeah, that is saying something. I figured Dr. Powell would be some jilted scientist who roped the monster into a revenge scheme, but no, he's just in two panels and he's gone.
Yeah, he's gone, you know?
I mean, I don't even know why they even bothered showing him, honestly. But did you catch this mistake? Powell tells his assistant, stand back while I lower the temperature inside his plastic glass casing. And then the assistant responds, lower the temperature, but Dr. Powell, isn't that extremely dangerous? What if it's alive. I think Roy meant raise, not lower the temperature.
Right.
Since cold is the creature's weakness, and he's already in a block of ice.
Right.
You know?
So, I mean, that did, I was like, what?
Yeah.
You know, I thought the same thing, yeah.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I'm surprised somebody along the way hasn't edited that in, like, the collected editions or the version on Marvel Unlimited, which is what we read, so. Jean knocks out that guard by pushing him with her mind and making him pass out. Dark Phoenix is in there, damn it.
I mean, you know.
He could have had a concussion or
anything.
You know, I mean, it's like, it's pretty, it seems pretty harsh. So, the monster is very Kirby-esque looking. If I didn't know better, I would wonder if Kirby didn't redraw all the monster images. He's got the same look, but, you know, from the cover, but tattered. He's got tattered pants instead of the moccasin boots.
Mm-hmm.
But he does have a very Kirby
look
about him, yeah. Of course, George Tesca, you know, had a little Kirby-isms to him as inker, you know, but. Now, why and how can he absorb Cyclops' optic blasts?
I don't know.
And later have Magneto.
Magnetic powers.
Because Magneto isn't even around. So it's like, where did that come from? Why is it in the novel? So, Iceman does freeze the curator of the museum, who is packing a gun.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of surprising. Only one security guard, but the curator is packing. So maybe that's why they don't need more security guards. So, I did find it funny. Angel observes some of the destruction the monster has left in his wake and says, he's piled up a bunch of cars down there like they were Aurora models. Yeah, that has to be a direct nod to the Aurora monster models, which were huge throughout the 60s and began, of course, with the Frankenstein
Monster.
Well,
did you catch? I mean, to me, that's a product placement. And then earlier in the book, Beast talks about, man, that's going to give me a headache. Even Excedrin can't touch.
Yeah.
I'm like, wonder what the kickback was on that.
Marvel liked to make little pop culture references. They didn't care about giving free advertising as long as they, you know, made. And it's kind of funny because later when they reprinted the early Spider-Man stories in Marvel Tales, originally Aunt May would say, come on, Peter, let's sit down and watch the Beverly Hillbillies. And she actually said that in the comic.
Yeah.
And when they reprinted in Marvel Tales in the early 80s, she said, come on, Peter, let's sit down and watch the Dukes of Hazzard.
Okay.
They did it now. I don't know what they put on. You know, it's like, let's watch,
Friends or
Pawn Stars or something. I don't know. Yeah, some whatever. Duck, I guess if you were going for redneck stuff, Duck Dynasty or something a few years back, something like that. So, the X-Men steal a helicopter from the Pan Am building. I'm beginning to see why no one trusts them.
Uh-huh. We're just going to take this.
Yeah.
Thanks.
We don't have a Blackbird jet yet, so we're going to take this. When the team gets an unwelcome reception from the ship hands, Iceman thinks, uh-oh, Homo sapiens are suspicious enough of us anyway. And now under new costumes, Scott and Jean aren't even recognizable. The X-Men got new uniforms just one issue before, but Cyclops barely changed his.
Right.
And he just eliminated that kind of yellow torso vest thingy they all wore for their school uniform. So it's like, that's going to make him not recognize him. But I did think it's interesting how many times they refer to humans as being like a separate species in this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just like,
I mean, it's just a few pages and then you see several mentions of that.
Yeah, yeah. What did you think of their costumes in this era? I mean, what did you think of them?
Yeah, they look like wrestling leotards.
Yeah. I like everyone else's, particularly Jean's. I think that's sharp. And it's actually, I think, the outfit she's wearing now in the comics.
Right,
back to
right.
That. But I always thought Angel's outfit is hideous. I mean, it's like he's got a blue cowl and a yellow shirt. He's got those suspender things going on.
Yeah.
It just—it looks like he looks like he, like they always said Alan Scott did, got dressed in the dark, but Alan's actually looked good and his doesn't. Yeah, so it's, I never did like that one. When I think Neil Adams came up with the cool.
And when I say wrestling leotard, I'm talking about, you know, like
Lucha
WWE,
Libre.
You know.
Oh, okay, that type of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not like wrestling. Yeah, so. So they rough up the crew, and then they ask permission from the captain while Jean has him hoisted 30 feet in the air with her mind.
I mean, what's he going to do? Say no?
Yeah. How does he know she's not going to just, like, slam him into the ship or dump him into the ocean or something? Yeah. But again, why didn't the monster use these powers that he shows on the ship in the novel? You know, did Mary Shelley just leave that part out? I mean,
Don't try, honey. Just.
Iceman does disobey orders briefly, but catches some barrels the monster was throwing, so he doesn't quite follow Xavier's orders to the letter at first. But then we learned that this thing came from another world and survived 150 years But Xavier's just fine with just killing it.
And the whole thing, what gets me is the whole point of X-Men is to be accepting of people's differences. But, oh, it's different than us, so out.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, really? Like,
let him blow up, you know. Just blow him up. Like, just keep, you know, it's like, why couldn't they have, like, have Iceman just freeze him enough to get him back to the mansion and put him in something and try to
talk to him.
Reason, talk to him. Say, what did you think about the alien origin ending?
I'm sorry, but just no.
You didn't see that coming, did you? See that coming. Yeah, and why would Mary Shelley change that to guy makes monster out of corpses? One is just as fantastical as the other.
Mm-hmm.
And then we learn that Jean mind wiped the crew of the entire skirmish. But unfortunately, we can't be mind wiped of reading this, can we?
No, you owe me. All I got to say is, yeah.
Roy Thomas would revisit the Frankenstein myth in his Young All-Star series. A much more faithful version of Shelley's monster would figure into a story arc there. And, of course, he was the editor-in-chief at Marvel when they launched their Monster of Frankenstein series. So I don't know what this thing was, but in the Marvel Universe, that creature that emerged in the Monster of Frankenstein comic was the monster from Shelley's novel. And, of course, it was real in-universe, you know. And they followed the novel, you know, his origins were the novel. So, not saying everything they did with him afterwards was, you know, but he was not an android. He was made like, you know, I mean, it was, you know, and I think they peppered in a little universalisms because she's very vague on how he's created and everything, but how he's given life. But I have to say, as a kid, I never cared much for Don Heck or George Tuska, but I have grown to appreciate both of them a lot more, and their early Marvel stuff is really nice. I feel like Heck was often inked poorly, but Tuska gives everything a nice weight to it, and it looks just like a 60s Marvel comic should.
Right. I mean, yeah, I get that.
Yeah, it's a nice-looking book. Seriously, it's not that bad, but Marvel books of the 60s are often way more goofy than most folks make them out to be. They're still very charming, but they're very goofy. The difference between Marvel's output and DC's output at this time is literally the characterization.
Mm-hmm.
The characters are given more unique voices. They have personalities. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes them seem more mature, a little more mature, a little more aimed at a little more sophisticated audience, because it ain't plots like this.
No.
And not to be harsh on it, because Roy Thomas has written a ton of great stuff that I love, but this is just... It's silly, but it's fun, and I don't mean to, you know, it's of its time, and it's fun, but it's not, you know, this ain't the FF fighting Galactus by any means, yeah. So, well, that will do it for our first trip to the House of Frankenstein for this year. Before we go, I'd like to plug a great new show I've been listening to, Terror at Collinwood. That's a podcast about Dark Shadows, produced and hosted by TV horror host Penny Dreadful, aka Danielle Gallagher, and it takes a look at the show one storyline at a time with special themed episodes peppered in. I learned about it because she guested it on Monster Kid Radio, Derek M. Cook's Monster Kid Radio, which of course we always plug here on House of Frankenstein. Danielle had some great guests on, and whether you are a diehard Dark Shadows fan or a more casual one, there's plenty of great discussion to enjoy. Danielle is also a big superhero and toy fan as well, and she has even worked on the Masters of the Universe line for Mattel, writing character bios.
Hmm.
So, yeah. So
it doesn't hurt that she has the same first name as our daughter.
That's right. That's true. Yeah. So definitely check that out. She doesn't have a promo trailer to run. I asked her if she had one. She said, no, unfortunately, I haven't made one yet. So that's why I'm plugging it this way. So definitely check it out. A special thanks to our Patreon supporters for information on how you can support the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Visit patreon.com/FW podcast. Extra special thanks to Jorge Luis Castillo, Matt Ryan, Neil Whitney, and Rocket Dan Johnson. They specifically support JLU Cast.
Yes, thank you so very much.
Yes, thank you guys. And since we're not doing JLU Cast for a few months, we thought we'd give them a shout out here. Special thanks as always to our friend Terry O'Malley, aka Ward Hill Terry, or Ward Hills Have Eyes Terry, for the House of Frankenstein theme. Terry's band, Stop Calling Me Frank, has a new single, Hard Lovin' Man, which is slated for release in November. Available digitally from Bandcamp or on vinyl from Rum Bar Records. Follow the band on their Facebook page. Check the show notes for more info. Come back in just 2 weeks, and we'll have part two of this year's House of Frankenstein series for you. Bye.
Bye, guys.
Supermates is a Franklin and Franken production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide. It is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright their respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders, and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue my mommy and daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com.
Comments can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for Supermates and FW Podcast Network. Follow us on Twitter by using the hashtag FW Podcast.
Please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.
What have I done?
I'm Igor. I have the strength of 100 men. I cannot die. I cannot be destroyed. I, Igor, will live forever.
I've created 100 times the monster that my father made.